Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm joined for this very special episode where we're just going to talk about whatever by the man with the golden hum, JB.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
It is.
Because we got snow.
We are buried in the stuff.
The good kind where, like, an art director on a movie. No, sorry. That it sticks to everything. So for as long as it stays cold, it's like a Christmas card.
Yes and no. When it sticks to everything, it's, I'm pretty sure it's killing some of the trees in the back because it's so heavy.
I've noticed that in my neighborhood, although that is not the first thing I noticed.
You hate trees.
I didn't look out through the window and say, oh.
I'm more of a glass is half empty of dead
trees
season kind of a guy.
Although on the way here, boy, was there an accident on the two main streets. Oh, my Lord, and everyone was trying to find their way around it. It looked really bad. Hey, folks, drive safe.
If you're
listening
to this,
I know a lot of you listen to this in your car.
We hope you're okay.
It's slippy. It's the season of dead trees and car accidents.
Yeah.
Ho, ho, ho.
Our apologies for being off last week. Hopefully everybody understands. It was Thanksgiving week. I didn't see a ton of sense in posting a show on a day where no one's at work. Everyone's just preparing for Cyber Monday. They've bypassed Black Friday altogether.
Yes.
And now it's just all about the Cyber Monday. Johnny Mnemonic was right.
As more and more people are getting that Wednesday off.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of school districts have traded Veterans Day for the Wednesday before Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
You get a super spectacular Thanksgiving weekend in our area. In our area, the kids got an extra day.
That's right.
Because of a
snow day,
which would have made it a 6-day weekend.
The actual snow day was almost nothing like the hilarious movie Snow Day.
No.
Which was disappointing.
I stayed in the house.
Movies are a lie.
I stayed in the house with a roaring fire going, literally.
Nice.
And my next door neighbor, who I love, we kind of went in on this snow removal service. But
that's
he's type
call.
A. Oh. And they came out at 3 a.m. and didn't wake us up, which led him to conclude they didn't bring snow plows and snow blowers. They came out and shoveled it, which is weird because it didn't wake either of us up. They came out at 3 thinking these two dudes have to get out of their driveway to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't because we're both retired.
Mm-hmm.
So at 9 a.m., I get the first call from the neighbor who loves to call me. Think they're going to come out again? A lot of snow came down since 3. I don't know.
Yeah.
You want to call him? Okay. I'll call him.
Yeah.
So the punchline of this is, as the day wore on, they did come back out and do it again.
Okay.
But this involved no less than 4 phone calls.
Holy cow.
I think he's lonely and he wants to talk to someone. I'll talk to him.
Sure.
Got nothing better to do.
We are entering the final month of the year, which means, you know, a lot of our special episodes. We do our overrated, underrated episode. We do, Adam Risky and I, of course, we'll do the annual holiday show, which we're in the process of trying to figure out. It's going to be hard to top the Postman.
And all of our listeners are going to have to shift into Overwatch because so much good stuff comes out at the holidays, although this year might be the exception.
Does it?
I'm looking at the release list and I'm like, well,
we're going to get to this because I want to talk about some preliminary.
There's one film in particular I want to talk about.
Okay. We're going to get to this because that was, you know, this all culminates in our annual Favorites of the Year episode, which is, of course, a show that people really like and I really like to record. But man, I have been trying to do some preliminary lists and I am in sorry shape.
And this might be due to the fact that if December goes the way I think it's going to go, I will hit 156 for the year in a theater. That's 3 a week. And maybe because I cast my net wide, I'm willing to go out on a limb right now and say it's been a good year for movies.
Good.
Part of it, though, is we're already starting to forget, like the Academy, we're already starting to forget stuff that came out earlier in the year.
Yeah.
So just recently on Twitter, I was Twitterizing, or whatever you call it, when
that's
looking for something interesting to read.
Twitterizing.
And I was reminded that both Annihilation and Eighth Grade were this year.
And I think the problem is that I'm broken because I liked both of those movies, but I don't know if I'd put them on a list.
I really liked both of those movies.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you put them on a list?
I don't know. If I do, it's because I have two more spots to fill, and they were good.
Oh, okay.
But I don't feel a personal connection or love or excitement over either of them.
Well, it's complicated, but I'm more
excited. It's complicated. It's still my number one.
Than the other. But that was years ago, and that was that delightful romantic comedy.
It was not delightful.
No. I really liked it.
No, I did. So I've been listening to
half of it works.
A podcast I really like called Blank Check, and they do these director series where they pick a director and they go through.
They only talked about the film Disney's Blank Check.
I wish. No, they did do an episode on Blank Check. It started as a Star Wars podcast, and then it became, I'm just advertising their show now, and then it became movies about directors who have a big hit and then get to make weird, idiosyncratic blank check movies and how that turns out. And so they go through these director series. The most recent one they did was Nancy Meyers. And so I've gone through and watched a handful of Nancy Meyers movies, including It's Complicated.
They're very much all of a piece.
I remember thinking Something's Gotta Give is good. I like that movie.
It's good. It's overly complicated and long.
And yet, it's complicated. Less complicated, but also way too long. Her movies are all too long, by the way.
Her movies were all made for my mom.
Yeah.
And the joke's on her because my mother didn't go to the movies.
Yeah.
I think I've told the story that at the end of her life, we went to see... Meet the Fockers?
Little Fockers?
It was Little Fockers.
Was it really the third one?
And she just had the greatest time.
I tapped out after Meet the Fockers.
My son and I only had a good time because she was having such a great time.
Sometimes that's all you need.
We're like, we have to do this more often. And in the car on the way home, she said, I got to go to more movies. The last time I saw a movie in the theater was with your father. We went to The Sting.
Wow.
And that's 75?
Yeah. Right?
Wow.
I might have that wrong.
Good streak.
Speaking of which.
But the Nancy Meyer films would be at the beginning of the VHS boom. I think I've mentioned we had the first VCR on the block, and my parents would send me to the one video store. Johnny, get something I like. Something with a story.
Mm-hmm.
All of Nancy Meyer's films would have delighted my mother on VHS.
Yeah, I remember going to see Something's Gotta Give and knowing that it wasn't for me, and yet I still thought it was good. And it was like, thank goodness somebody's making a movie about people of this age that isn't just, aren't old people funny? Not that they were old, but...
And there's a remake coming out.
No, the remake is of What Women Want.
What
men want. Do you see what they did?
Right, but...
They flipped
the original
script, J. Bones.
Right. No, I know it's a... Like first, Overboard.
Before it was women.
Right.
But now...
But the first one is Nancy Meyers.
She directed that movie, didn't write it.
Oh, okay.
It is not good. That's another one that I rewatched. I really am not a fan of that movie.
Well, and now...
And it's especially hard to watch.
Now there's...
Mel Gibson play a scumbag,
there's
right?
There's this big rock in the road.
Woof, woof.
I like the scene where...
No.
It's... who's the one who can hear? Helen Hunt?
Mel Gibson.
No.
Hears what women
but
want.
But who's the female lead?
Helen Hunt.
Okay. The scene where
fresh off her Oscar.
The scene where he calls her sugar tits. That's a new low.
Oh, there's so many Mel Gibson quotes we could name right now because they've played that tape so many times on Stern.
Yeah.
Talking about The Sting made me think of Butch Cassidy, which of course reminds me.
Yes.
R.I.P. William Goldman. R.I.P. Bernardo Bertolucci. R.I.P. Nicholas Rogue. R.I.P. Ricky Jay.
Yeah.
What the fuck? We go away for 2 weeks, people.
And, of course, I get all my obituary news now on the Twitter machine. And my wife brought that up last night. She said, did you hear Bernardo Bertolucci died? And I said, oh, that explains because not all of them are phrased as RIP tweets.
Okay.
That should be a rule in Twitter. You
okay.
talk about someone because they just passed on. It should start with RIP.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that's why there were all those Bernardo Bertolucci tweets.
Well, usually the inverse is true. Usually it's like, why is everyone talking about this person? Oh, shit, did they die? And then you find out, no, they didn't. Okay.
But if the alternative to did they die was they just did or said something horrible.
Yeah, that's true.
It's never good.
No, that's
like,
true.
Why is everyone talking about Chrissy Teigen? She had a baby.
Scorsese's birthday.
John Legend is a papa.
That's a thing, right?
I was so lucky because I'm going to make this not circuitous. That theater I used to go to that Adam Riske famously quipped, you were always waiting for the wrecking ball. Around the corner is a magazine store.
Mm-hmm.
How does this place stay open? They sell magazines. And one day, the guy behind the counter mentioned to me, I don't know why, that Ricky Jay is coming to town. And I immediately went home and got tickets. And I got to see that show where he had this enormous screen with little squares of things. And he would let the audience pick. And every square led to a story and a trick. It was like Ricky Jay's Rogues Gallery, although that's not what the show is called. And so every night you saw it, it was different because he just let you pick. Amazing and Unbelievable doesn't. One of the stories that is in the New Yorker piece that a lot of people were reposting in light of his death, the New Yorker in 93 did this. It's really long. It takes a really long time to read. That one of Ricky Jay's favorite magician was Max Mellini, who was really amazing. And he used to perform at dinner parties where the opportunity to set things up in advance and bring props was limited. And at one point, someone said, do a magic trick with my hat. And Max Mellini put a card under the hat. And when he picked up the hat, the card was gone. And in its place was a 5-pound cube of ice. And he told that story that night at the live show. And the more you think about that, especially given that this is the turn of the century, well, how would you get that into the house? Where would you hide it?
Because magic is real. And magnets, how do they work?
No one knows. I once saw a big display at O'Hare Airport.
Yeah.
I was on my way somewhere.
Yeah.
And I tweeted this out, too.
Okay.
It was a multi-thing about magnets.
Yeah.
And the bottom line was of this display at O'Hare Airport.
How do they work?
No one knows.
We have no idea.
No one knows. At the end, there was a place where you could fill out a card
if
you wanted to perhaps make a guess.
Yeah.
So I wrote, I'm no scientist.
J-Bones, have you seen anything good lately?
Well, I'm telling you, I think this has been a good year. For the first time, I'm trying not to be such an elitist, and there's a whole bunch of stuff to see that perhaps never makes it to a theater, where I think we're going to have to sort of start expanding our definition.
Sure.
Although I like to be a purist, and in two cases, actually just one of the films I want to talk about today deserves a theatrical release.
I suspect I know what it
is. If only because even on the television, it was like breathtakingly beautiful.
I might not agree.
That it was breathtakingly beautiful?
Correct.
Okay. Now we have a Mexican standoff or whatever ethnicity. I don't want to be accused of being.
It's just a standoff.
Comcast, in trying to make things easier for people, has let you use your cable box as a portal to Netflix.
Okay.
You can access your Netflix account through the cable box.
Good.
But because I think Comcast is largely an evil corporation, in my case, it looks bad.
Sure.
It looks like someone filming Netflix from a video projector off a wall, and about every 6 seconds, there's a frame that stutters.
Mm-hmm.
Like if there's
different. It looks different on every
Streaming device.
Every Roku, whether it's Roku or Apple TV, I used to be able to watch it through my Blu-ray player. Every way I watch it, it looks different.
So I was very frustrated, but in this case, my wife and I were watching something that was so compelling, you could kind of forget. But when it came time to sit down and watch something else, I went through the Apple TV, which I didn't normally do. And God bless the people from Apple. Everything on Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime looks stunning on the Apple TV. So thanks for the convenience, Comcast. But
do your devices, your Roku or your Apple TV, do they stream in 4K? Because I know you got that 4K action.
I do, but the only way I can actually watch certified 4K is through the through the dedicated Blu-ray player that does 4K.
Got it.
Because that's the only one that's going right into the TV.
Got it.
Because the soundbar people lied and there's a lawsuit. I think I've talked about this. And if I were to do the Apple TV correctly, which would be putting new wires in the walls and rip.
I get it. Listen.
It looks spectacular, though. Every so often, I don't know if you get this down here. I'm assuming you do. When the Apple TV goes to the screensaver,
yeah,
it's like this ultra high definition thing that moves subtly. There's cityscapes. There's one of the Earth.
I kind of remember, but not really.
One of these mountains with this. It's like you could watch the screensavers all night long. It's that entertaining. So I switched to the Apple TV to watch The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, and I'm so glad I did.
Yes,
because that movie looks terrific. In fact, it tricks you because the mise-en-scene of the first two or three segments is muddy and full of smoke and dust and things. When we get to the prospector sequence, it was astounding the way it looked on my TV. So I was glad I went through the Apple TV, glad I said, well, I'll stick with Comcast for cable stuff. Were you not impressed with how Buster Scruggs looked?
I wasn't, although now to hear you talk about it, yes, by the time we get to Tom Waits, I think I started to turn around on it. I found myself, and I really liked the movie. It may very well end up on my top 10
list. It's astonishingly good.
Yeah. And I didn't, we just put it on. It showed up on Friday. Erica and I put it on Friday. I didn't even know that it was an anthology. It was just, hey, new Coen Brothers movie. I know Tim Blake Nelson is in it. Here's the title. That's all I knew. So it starts, and we have this story about Tim Blake Nelson, and I'm like, well, this is wacky, and this is very Coen Brothers. And then the story resolves, and I was like, oh, okay, I didn't know this was a thing. And so we get all these different stories, and every single one of them are very Coen Brothers.
Yes.
I think it might end with the weakest one, which is an issue that I have, but I understand why it ends with the one it ends with.
Yes.
But I found myself a little frustrated for the first several segments because I felt like, man, Westerns should feel more cinematic. And am I not feeling like it is because we're here watching it at home instead of on a big screen where it would feel more cinematic? Or does it have something to do with the actual cinematography? Because it looked to me and felt very digital, that it was shot digitally, that there was a lot of fucking around with the color timing and manipulation
of the image.
Right, which is fine. But so I was struggling with how it looked until it got to Tom Waits and it opens up. And then the Zoe Kazan one opens
is also
up. Yeah.
I think even that was deliberate. Although, as you hinted at, I think there's a very specific reason the stories are presented in the order that they're presented. And another great thing about Buster Scruggs was there was some people at our Thanksgiving get-together who had seen it.
Oh, that's nice.
Because
yeah,
it's on Netflix it's there, and I have time, and you don't have to wait for relatives to go out to the theater. And we had this wonderful animated discussion where I was so happy that the family members who had seen it had loved it.
Good.
And we were just going on and on about, A, how great it was, and B, an interesting question about the last segment.
Okay.
And I think I'm not going to give it away, but you can guess what that question is.
Yeah.
And I suggested that if you'd been watching the entire thing carefully and considering the structure of each individual piece, I think that question is answered.
Yeah, and there's a specific through line that runs through all of them.
Which I also appreciated.
Sure.
Because not everyone who makes an anthology bothers to, why are these being presented and other things are not? Or even, as we mentioned before, why are you telling these stories in this order?
I think it's a movie that is only, I think, like with a lot of Coen Brothers movies, I think it's going to take a little time for people to really embrace it. I think part of it is the model that, like, oh, it's just this thing that showed up on Netflix. It feels a little less special.
But look at the cast. Oh, of course. The cast alone.
And also, I think the nature of it being an anthology automatically turns the discussion to this one's good, this one's not, this one's good, this one's not, as opposed to sort of considering it as a whole. I found myself, again, A, trying to wrap my head around some of it, but also delighted at just watching a new Coen Brothers movies, new Coen Brothers movie because of their use of language. I mean, there were so many yes. lines that just made me smile.
My lovely wife and I discovered, as we discussed the film, and then later at Thanksgiving, we discovered that as we talked about the film, everyone was ignoring one of the segments as if it wasn't in the movie at all.
Which one?
And I wondered why.
Liam Neeson?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why is that? Because it's very short?
It's not very short.
Because of all of them, again, I don't want to spoil it.
It's the darkest.
It's very.
It's the darkest thing
it's very,
in
very
a movie
dark.
This year.
But also, I think it's the Coen brothers slyly talking about the types of entertainment
Absolutely.
That are popular.
Absolutely.
Because, good Lord. I thought the James Franco segment was arranged or written or structured so that the entire thing becomes a Shaggy Dog story.
Yeah, it was.
Leading up to his last line. Which is funny. Would that spoil it?
That's a pretty girl?
No.
First time?
First time.
Oh, that's an amazing line. But his yeah. last line is, that's a pretty girl. Hmm. Which, again, may recontextualize the whole thing. But first time is really funny.
Yeah.
Really funny. That one felt the slightest. Although, again, hopefully I'm not giving anything away out of context. Stephen Root yelling pan shot.
I was going to say, for days afterward, that's the line Jane and I were repeating. Ding, pan shot! And someone just recently, I don't know if this was a magazine piece or just some anonymous person on Twitter, was posting pictures of him from a whole bunch of his different film roles yeah. and saying, this man is a national treasure. Yeah. And every movie he's in, he except maybe for his body type, you could actually imagine someone not believing if you
sure.
took two of the extreme characterizations, maybe Milton being one because he's very made up, that you would be surprised that it was the same actor.
I'm guessing you never watched News Radio?
I occasionally watch News Radio, and he was the boss, right?
He was, and he was very funny on that show, creating a character that just has never been on TV before.
And that was back when I had no idea who he was and was basically watching it for
Dave Foley.
Dave Foley.
Yeah.
All of you within the sound of our voice need to watch Buster Scruggs or borrow someone's Netflix password or go to someone's house.
It's a new Coen Brothers movie. Like, how can you not? And then It's
so good.
It's really good. Again, I feel like the narrative may become it's uneven because it's episodic. And while I didn't like every segment as much as all of them, and the James Franco one feels a little slight, and you know, one of the first things I said was, it might end on the weakest segment.
The Franco thing is a Shaggy Dog story. I appreciated the segment Empresario because what he's performing is a whole bunch of the stuff I used to teach. And it was like, oh, Ozymandias, I used to teach that. And
the meal ticket one? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because of his character's name, yes.
Got it.
The segment is called Meal Ticket.
Which I didn't realize until, because they would tell you the name.
Right.
And you would forget it. And then they would end with the book closing. And this was just, I just listened to a Slash Filmcast episode about this. And they pointed this out. But I noticed it too. If you read the text.
Yes.
It gives you a little bit, there's the girl who got rattled, last line.
Yes, is.
Is amazing.
Is essential.
And it's not spoken.
No.
It's just in the book. It's so.
Imagine the Coen brothers are expecting us to read something on screen. But the whole conceit of the book with the color plates.
Oh my gosh.
And It's very delightful.
It is. Just quickly back to, and I'm not trying to jump in because we'll come back to it when I talk about what I've seen, but I was having all these doubts. I'm trying to understand why I'm processing the look of the film the way that I am. Is it me? Is it the movie? What is it?
I think go ahead. I'm sorry.
A day or two later, and this probably is not a fair standard by which to compare it. A day or two later, we watched for the first time Heaven's Gate. And I was like, well, see, this is what it's supposed to be. Again, probably an unfair standard.
Sure.
That's like one of the most beautiful movies I've ever seen.
Yes.
But I was like, yeah, this is a Western. This is.
Even when it's dusty and smoky, it's
yes.
the most beautiful
yes.
Rembrandt-like
right,
dust
exactly.
and smoke.
So then it just, it brought some of my frustration with the aesthetics of Buster Scruggs into greater focus. That's all.
But I think, and I like to think this is deliberate, because it definitely goes from small mm-hmm. and claustrophobic and dark and dusty to the prospector sequence, which is beautiful,
yeah.
and then the girl who got rattled sequence, which is also much bigger, and then we get dark
yeah.
again,
yeah.
and then in the stagecoach, it's dark to
right.
light to lighter to light, which is delightful. I think if you went back and tried not to be as distracted, because I too was distracted by the digitiness
mm-hmm.
of the end of the Tim Blake Nelson sequence.
Got it.
That it. This is not
which is delightful.
Trying to look realistic.
right.
In fact, it's trying to look a lot like those book plates
mm-hmm.
where it's a mm-hmm. painting. But this is a quibble. All of you need to see Buster Scruggs.
My plan is to watch it again before I make my top 10 list to see, A, if it's on there. I suspect it is. And B, where it is. Because I remember I did kind of a last-minute rewatch of Hail Caesar a couple years ago. And I was like, oh, no, this is for sure on there.
And I did the same thing and had the opposite reaction because I have not yet come around.
It's going to happen.
You think?
I do.
I haven't come around on that other thing yet.
What's the other thing?
Burn after reading?
I think Hail Caesar's better.
Is it possible?
Burn after reading is 100% a Shaggy Dog joke.
Is it possible to come around on?
No. Lady Killers?
Yeah.
No.
I still remember going to see that in the theater. My expectations were through the roof.
The trailer was really fun. I've never seen the Alec Guinness one, but the trailer was fun, and Tom Hanks was doing something funny, and him saying, waffles, we must have waffles forthwith, always made me laugh. But that's the only one of their movies. I'm an apologist for Intolerable Cruelty. It
mm-hmm.
doesn't feel like a Coen Brothers movie,
no.
really, but it's a passable comedy.
And there's a lot to like in Hudsucker,
yeah.
too.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Lady Killers is the only movie of theirs that I just do not like. It's the only one.
Still, their batting averages.
Oh, it's unbelievable. What else besides Buster Scruggs?
Well, along the same lines, we got suckered into watching Haunting of Hill House on Netflix.
I still haven't seen it.
And it is so much better than it has any right to be. Horror on TV is difficult. This is very much a television show, not a movie. The 10-hour-long segments is also an impediment. I have one quibble, but it's one of the best things I've seen this year. It's astonishing what the people who made it did with the book and adapting the book. They've made tremendous changes to the book. Basically, all that remains is it's a haunted house and it's this entity and don't cross it. Their decision to make it a family instead of these sort of random people who are there to research it was brilliant. The structure of each episode is brilliant. The performances are amazing. Henry Thomas plays
Elliot.
He goes up for a name and it's not there. Henry Thomas plays Timothy Hutton as a young man. And
got it. Okay.
It works
yeah.
beautifully.
I don't think I even knew Timothy Hutton was in it. I knew Henry Thomas was.
Incredibly scary when it wants to be. I was talking to Mike at Days of the Dead, and he was a little farther in it than I was, and Adam was asking us about it, and we were both, no, leave Days of the Dead, which is disappointing this year, and go and watch Hill House. And Mike said there was an image in one of the episodes, and he didn't want to spoil it, that is permanently burnished in his brain, and he'll never forget it. So the whole while we're watching, my wife and I are trying to figure out what that image was, and we guessed wrong, because the minute we finished, I texted Mike, you got to tell me what it is.
Yeah.
And when he told me, I was like, well, that makes perfect sense, because that's the series' biggest twist.
Okay.
But there is a scare in The Haunting of Hill House, and it's 10-hour-long episodes, and I'm not going to tell you what episode it's in. It is one of the best jump scares I've seen in my life. I'm in my living room, and Jan and I jump a fucking mile. My stomach leapt into my throat. It was so fucking scary.
Did you have the lights on and everything?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's so rare. And in a way, maybe they were lulling you into a false sense of complacency. Because after the first three episodes, you're like, okay, I see how this is going. And of course it isn't. It's not a movie. It's a 10-hour miniseries. It is so good. You have to watch it.
I promise I will. Have you... I don't feel like you've checked out much of Mike Flanagan's stuff. Correct? The guy who did the show.
And what else has he done?
So he did Oculus.
Which I have not seen.
He did a movie called Hush that went right to Netflix.
And I have not seen that.
And he did the adaptation of Gerald's Game that went right to Netflix.
Which I've read about, but I haven't seen.
Okay.
So there you go. So he is foisted on me, fully formed. This guy knows what he's doing.
He's good. He hasn't done anything yet that I think is genuinely great. Everything he's done has been very small. But it's always good at being small.
My only quibble, and those of you listening to this who have seen Hill House can agree or disagree, write what you think in the comments. It does not stick the landing. Hmm. It is so magnificently wonderful about keeping all these balls in the air. It fumbles a bit in the final episode, but you might sit there and say, there is no way to reach a satisfying hour-long conclusion to what we just saw in the last 9 hours. One story arc in particular just leaves you scratching your head. But that's a quibble. It's so incredibly good. And maybe you don't believe me, but I don't know much. But I know horror stuff.
Yeah, I believe
you. It's so good.
I believe you.
It's so good.
All right, cool.
And also says a lot of things about families.
Houses. Oh.
Families.
Got it.
Houses are bad. You've learned this.
I don't want one.
I mean, you need one to keep you out of the cold and have a place to sleep, but houses are the worst. When I bought my first house 35 years ago, I used to get so frustrated, I used to fling open the front door, ask Jan, and shout into the cul-de-sac, I love being a homeowner! Because I'd get so frustrated. It's nothing but
it sucks.
Problems and things to fix and bills.
Yeah.
You'd be better off in a tent. But a tent it's not comfortable and you get cold.
And there's nowhere to use the bathroom.
A separate tent, a smaller.
The poop tent?
In essence, yes.
What else have you seen?
Okay. Wanting to see this in a movie theater, although that became difficult for a number of reasons because it wasn't playing on as many screens as it should have. And after the first week, of course, some of these theaters,
it played for a week.
We need more screenings of The Grinch. So you had theaters where it was only showing once a day at 10 at night.
At night.
So we went to a theater.
Things to say about.
We had a theater that's a little farther away where you're sort of coerced into eating dinner, which wasn't ideal, but we wanted to see it on a big screen. I got to see the remake of Suspiria in an actual movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so incredibly good, and it is a masterpiece. I would argue it's a better film than the original.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have as much affection for the original as you do, but I love the original.
Mm-hmm.
But you at least have to say that the remake is more ambitious in what it's covering.
Yes.
Oh, you finally saw it.
I did. I agree that it is more ambitious.
Yes.
I will always prefer the original.
Okay.
Because even though it aims lower, I think it hits the target more.
Okay.
And it's more of the kind of movie that I think I respond to.
Sure.
So really wanted to see the new one. Really want to see it. Like one of my most anticipated movies. Just so curious. And didn't get to see it during the week it was out here because of everything that's going on.
And meanwhile, the Music Box,
so
which is a long car ride away, is showing it four times a day.
Correct. However, we did a little research because Erica was trying to find things to do to that would get me out of the house, that would help. She said, well, we could go to the Music Box to see Suspiria. I said, before we do that, let me pull up the website, because Adam Risky turned me on to a little thing that that now the website tells you what theater it's in.
And it's already in the small
theater. It's in the closet. And I said, what would be the point?
Oh, yeah.
Because I knew we had a screener coming, because Amazon sends screeners every year, and this was an Amazon movie. So I think 2 days later, it showed up. So we watched it that night, and I thought, A, I'm so glad that we didn't drive to the Music Box to watch it in a closet, and B, I'm so glad I didn't try to go see this at 10:30 at night, the one time it was showing, because as we were watching it, I was like, oh, I never would have made it through this.
It is long.
Yes.
And feels long.
Yes. I don't know how crazy about it I am. I was impressed at how it was made. But I don't think I liked it all that much.
Hmm.
Yeah. And I know it's going to be, I know because Adam loves it. And so I'm sure when we get to our top 10 show, it's going to be.
We were talking about it,
you
guys, Days of the Dead.
Be me.
And Adam and I have very different tastes. And it really surprised me that Adam liked it. And my first reaction was, Adam liked it. Maybe I don't. Maybe I really don't. That's a joke. That. The basic trope of the film, which I don't want to give away, the revelation at the end, I thought was very clever. And also, even though you didn't like it half as much as me, would you agree that Dakota Johnson dancing Olga to death is a sequence that will be, that's...
Absolutely.
That's just...
I think the movie needed more of that.
Sure.
Because I think that's really the one set piece that we can pull out. And again, I recognize that the original is almost all set pieces, right? And
very
so,
much.
It was great and very upsetting. You know,
yeah.
It was. I really appreciate, because again, the whole time they've been talking about it for years. David Gordon Green was going to remake it with Natalie Portman, and every time it comes up. You know, your first question as somebody who loves the original is why? We have this thing that's perfectly good. Go make a new movie.
And
they did.
I would argue there are worse Dario Argento films that I would welcome remakes of.
Yeah, I guess.
How about a remake of Mother of Tears?
How about no? Just leave it forever. I really appreciate the fact that, like, there's witches and there's a dance studio. And those are... That's what this has in common.
Yeah, pretty much.
That it is an entirely different film.
It is its own thing.
It is about different things. It looks and feels completely aesthetically different. So to even compare it to the original is probably pointless. To say, well, the original was better. Well, they're completely different movies.
Yes.
I respond to one more than the other. I admire what it was trying to do and some of what it tried to say. Especially in the final minutes, it felt a little bit too little too late, and there are some choices made.
Which was my son's reaction.
Yeah.
He saw it way before we did, because, of course, in L.A. you get to see everything months early.
They just bring it to your house in L.A.
Along with the filmmakers who do
Q&A
it's
very
in
very nice.
Family room.
Time-consuming for the filmmakers.
From house to house to house. How many more houses on Mulholland? He felt the first hour was masterful, and then the second hour didn't deliver on the promise of the first hour. That was my son's reaction.
Well, I think when you spend an hour building to something, you have to build to something, and I maybe feel like it didn't totally. I think there are choices made, and we can talk about it, I guess, off mic. There's a specific choice of casting that it's impressive, but to what end?
Oh, okay. I think I know who you're talking about.
Yeah.
My only quibble was all the stuff on the radio that's trying to tie what's going on with actual news events of the time the film is, it takes place in, the Bader-Meinhof thing. I don't think that worked at all. But
no,
an interesting attempt.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it's a bad movie. I just watched it knowing.
I agree with what you said, that if it had been more Dakota Johnson dancing Olga to death, that could have been a half an hour. that would have been better, especially, and I didn't even think about it in this way, that one of the reasons why Argento Suspiria is so revered is that it really is. It's almost like a greatest hits.
Yeah, it's just scene after scene of that kind of stuff. And I want to say, maybe Elric talked about this on Shockwaves, that it's almost not a horror movie. And it's not to engage, because there are definitely things that are horrific, no question. So yes, it is. I'm not going to be the guy who's like, but really, it's not a horror movie. But it maybe could have been a little bit more of a horror movie, because outside of that sequence and then some stuff at the end, it's like, what are we doing? I don't know. I thought it was really interesting. I thought it was impressive. I thought the construction of it was really impressive. I'm glad that it exists. If you're going to remake Suspiria, I'm glad that it's this, that it's totally different, that it, you know, is a totally different approach to the material. It kind of left me cold.
Hmm.
Yeah. Sorry.
No.
No, I know. I feel bad.
And,
I didn't want to be
sitting there at Yorktown eating this food that I really didn't want, I thought to myself, this is not going to appeal to everyone.
For sure.
And then I went to see Green Book. I was forced to see Green Book because until recently I thought I was an Italian. I believed I was an Italian-American, and then I did Ancestry DNA, and surprise, you're not Italian at all, but you can still eat the food.
Well, that's nice.
Green Book is very entertaining.
Okay.
But I sit there and I feel uncomfortable because Green Book is Driving Miss Daisy and Rain Man.
Mm.
You get two characters who are different and you force them into a car. And in the case of Driving Miss Daisy, I think they made that part of the pitch. It's Driving Miss Daisy, but we reversed it. Mm. It's a white person driving. And
that reminds me of this movie coming out called What Men Want.
Yes.
See, what it used to be What Women Want.
With Taraji P. Henson.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But they switched it.
Who's making way too many movies this year. Taraji, you're a beautiful, talented woman. Slow down. So I'm sitting there and enjoying parts of the film, and it's certainly much better than Driving Miss Daisy, which I have famous antipathy towards. I even wrote a column about it. But the fact that it's based on a true story and the screenplay was co-written by the real guy's son.
Ah.
So these are two people who really existed. I was unfamiliar with the jazz musician character, Dr. Don Davis or something, but he was a real guy. He was a real jazz musician. And it does manage to avoid a lot of the pitfalls of stuff like Driving Miss Daisy, and there are set pieces that are entertaining, and Viggo Mortensen is never less than amazing. But throughout the entire thing, it's so formulaic. You know exactly where it's going. And I would argue that the character we're introduced to at the beginning of Green Book, the Viggo Mortensen character, is very racist.
Hmm.
The filmmakers have him do something at the beginning which is very racist.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they really needed to pay more attention to how he loses his overt racism as the film goes along, and that it happens way too fast.
Hmm.
It seems to me he watches the Dr. Davis character play the piano, and it is so beautiful that it's the cliche that art has the ability to. The relationship that's presented with the two men is good, and there's some jokes and stuff, but it's such a contrivance. From Viggo Mortensen's, you know, Goomba accent to Linda Cardellini, who's very entertaining, and I forget the actor's name, but
isn't it Mahershala Ali?
Right, and he was in Moonlight.
Yeah.
And
Academy Award winner,
Mahershala Ali. he creates this very specific character. It's just good enough that you wanted it to be better.
Sure.
And sort of explode the bounds of this cliche thing where...
Instead of just doing it again.
You know, Oscar Madison and Felix Unger go on a car journey, and what do you know, folks? They become friends. Spoiler alert. There's stuff to like in it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's worse holiday movies to spend 2 hours with, but it's just too formulaic.
I don't want to be the person who ever says, like, I will never see a movie, right? But I saw maybe a trailer for that, and I know my first thought was like, I probably don't need to see it. Not I never will, but
last night we watched Captain Fantastic again on
which I still haven't seen.
The cable, and Adam Riske's voice was echoing in our house. I will never see that movie. And in fact, people were commenting wherever that happened that he refused. And people were like, give it a shot. to which I can say to Adam Riske, Captain Fantastic, better movie than Green Book.
All right. Anything else on your list?
I got one more.
Yeah, let's do it.
And this is,
I think, what the show's going to be, everyone. So
this has been the source of Twitter controversy. Because
I'm not on Twitter.
You're very wise. Twitter's a weird... Like I said, someone died. There's much... Farhad Manjoo, my favorite tech writer, now works for a media where you have to pay, or I think I would have to subscribe to the Wall Street Journal. So I no longer read Farhad Manjoo on a regular basis. He used to write for Slate. He was my favorite writer. He cut himself off from social media for a month.
Okay.
And wrote a column about it. And it was fascinating because he said, one of the advantages was I would read the newspaper every morning and watch the network news every night, about a half an hour in the morning, about a half an hour at night. And he said, what this served to do was this was my time to be engaged with the world and perhaps to get angry or concerned, and that I wasn't monitoring everything 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. He said the other advantage was in both cases – experienced professionals were gathering the facts and presenting them in a coherent way.
Right.
He said there was a lot to be said for that. So I got all these impressions of what I'm about to talk about, mostly through the Twitter. And so we sat down to watch it, and it's a Netflix original, The Christmas Chronicles.
Oh, I haven't watched it yet. My kids have watched it 3 or 4 times.
Because one of the first things I was going to ask you when I got here was, have your kids seen it?
3 or 4 times.
And when you say that, why 3 or 4 times?
Because my son Charlie loves it. So he was downstairs and he puts on Netflix and he always wants to watch something he's seen, usually an episode of Bunked, which is
I know.
Not a good show.
I know what that is.
And I'm always saying, what if we gave something new a chance?
So it's a worse version of Salute Your Shorts, which my son watched when he was a kid.
So I think this was maybe the day that The Christmas Chronicles had dropped because we were home because he was off school. And it just popped up on the home screen. And I thought, well, I know that Kurt Russell made this crazy Christmas movie, so I'm putting this on. And he pushed back a little. What? So just give it a chance. Look, there's a brother and sister, just like you and Rosie.
Yeah.
And then I left the room, and I was like, I don't know how this is going to go. And an hour and a half later, he said, that was one of the best movies I've ever seen. So he's watched it, I think, every day since. I have not yet seen it. We may do a show on it, but...
What?
Yeah. It may factor into our holiday episode. I'm giving too much away, but...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's better than it has any right to be.
Kurt Russell.
It is a Hallmark Christmas movie gone right.
Okay.
That it has the look, it has the structure, it has the tropes. Later, I read a review on the Guardian UK website, and I don't think this is spoilers, first 10 minutes.
I think it's... Oh, I know. I already knew what it was going to be before it happened.
The opening montage is so happy.
Anytime you see home movies and dad's a firefighter.
You just know someone's going to die. Yeah. And they were right. But the Guardian UK hated it.
Okay.
And went on and on and on. I think what we have here is someone who's internalized every move and every trope and every line and every structure of a Hallmark Christmas movie and then said, but what if it was good? And The Guardian actually complained, the only thing in this that's worth a damn is Kurt Russell. Well, yeah, he's Santa.
Right.
He's supposed to be. So it's the standard Hallmark setup. The minute Kurt Russell shows up, it's like, oh, my God, he's thought this through. Mm-hmm. And there's an attitude. And even the script leaps, because maybe they did a rewrite for him, that what he's saying is actually clever. And this movie has a take on Santa that's a little different. And then, and this is my only quibble, and it shouldn't be a quibble in a Hallmark movie, the film lacks a clock. They have to get something done so there's Christmas. And the minute that's established, the whole thing slows down. And my wife and I are literally shouting at the screen, you can't spend time on that. Christmas is at stake. And then just when interest is lagging, they introduce the elves, which are the subject of some controversy on Twitter.
Uh-oh.
The elves are animated.
Something is controversial on Twitter.
Imagine. I saw people tweeting what the elves look like before I even knew what the Christmas Chronicles was. And half the people say, these are ugly and disturbing. And the other half, these are the cutest things I've ever seen. So your mileage may vary. All the stuff with the animated elves is very clever, and they speak this language that sounds like Norwegian. There's a musical number in the middle of it.
Okay, so more than once, because I'm around when the movie is on, but not engaged and not paying attention, it seems like every time I land on the movie, and I guess this is a spoiler, but I don't know why he's there or why any of it's happening, Santa is in jail.
Yes.
And singing a song with a band.
Yes.
And I feel bad that the few times I've seen it, 100% out of context, I find myself a little embarrassed for Kurt Russell.
Well, it's odd because, A, Santa is singing about himself in the third person.
As Santa does.
Also, one of the other inmates is little Steven Van Zandt of Bruce Springsteen's band.
I saw him on the guitar.
And the minute the musical number starts up, all the other inmates are his band, the Disciples of Soul. Because you recognize little Steven, you're like, and who are the other people?
Is Max Weinberg on drums?
And you have no idea who the other people are because it's a less well-known band. And they obviously chose that song because the most famous version is by Elvis. And Kurt Russell played Elvis in that TV movie.
He's doing some of the Elvis moves.
He's doing some of the Elvis moves. But you know what? In the spirit of a Bollywood film, I'm giving this revved up Hallmark movie so much credit that about every 15, 18 minutes, it knows how shitty it's getting. And let's have a musical number. Let's have these animated elves and all this wonderful stuff. It's better than it has any right to be.
All right.
Anyone who's shitting on it, come on.
I'm going to watch it for Kurt Russell playing Santa. And because my son loves it.
What's her name shows up? The actress I always confuse with Gabrielle Anwar.
Kimberly Williams Paisley.
Right, because I thought Gabrielle Anwar was the bride in the Steve Martin Father of the Bride, but it's not. It's Kimberly.
They were very similar in the 90s. Yeah, I could see that.
Goldie Hawn's son,
Oliver Hudson,
plays a small part.
Right.
There's another part later where one of the thugs is not identified in the credits or on the IMDb page. He's sort of the head thug at the place where they chop the cars apart. And we were thinking that maybe it was Wyatt Russell, but it's not.
Okay.
Because he looks nothing like Wyatt Russell.
Usually a good indicator.
But he sounds exactly like Kurt Russell at the beginning of Kurt Russell's career. So there's either weird looping going on, or that's someone's relative and they didn't take credit.
Sure.
Maybe someone can comment on this in the comments.
Santa, if you're listening, please explain.
Clearly, the greatest Christmas movie ever made is Miracle on 34th Street. I needn't argue this. But there's so much.
You've seen Reindeer Games. You can't just say things.
We did a commentary on Reindeer Games.
I know.
All of you know how much Christmas crap there is out there. This is worth watching.
My favorite Lifetime movie, Christmas Crap.
Well, last year, whenever we lighted upon the Hallmark Channel, or the Lifetime Channel or whatever it was, the same made-for-TV Christmas movie was playing. So we watched it in 10-minute segments out of order, and it was about this woman who goes back in time.
They're all actually about that.
To fix her town. And it was just – and I had never seen a Hallmark Christmas movie.
Yeah. It's a weird thing because they have become an industry.
Yeah.
And I remember for a while I feel like they were being embraced ironically. And now I feel like the irony has actually gone away. And now people just love them unironically. I remember our friend Margo.
I agree with you 100%.
Being the first person to just admit, like, I love these things. I can't defend it, but I love them.
And another thing in their defense, because it's not for me, but be my guest. Treat Williams is delightful, and I think we've spoken about how
just in general
we like him
100%.
Well, he is,
yeah,
because I started following him on Twitter.
Okay.
And he doesn't tweet too much, but what he tweets is delightful. And here's a man who is very happy with his life, and his tweets are full of wonderful things. And he related that he was traveling somewhere, and he has appeared in a number of these Hallmark Christmas movies, and that someone took him aside and explained to him exactly why they like them. And the reason made sense. And he said, this is why I'm happy that I do one of those every once in a while. Let's make some people happy. So I'm not going to be bitter about that.
Does he start every tweet with, like, a little treat for you?
No. It is free of nonsense.
Does he call himself Tweet Williams?
No. He is a working actor, and he travels all over the world to appear in things, and a lot of it is how beautiful where he is.
Sure.
So it's like, oh, I'll take that.
Right.
I wish
I'll
I was
do
there
this
too.
Movie. Right.
But he's clearly a very nice person.
Yes.
And so much of Twitter is not that.
Right.
That it's almost like, you know, sometimes on my way home from the grocery store, I stop at the rectory and talk to Father Brown for about 5 minutes. It makes me feel better. And this is the way I feel about Treat Williams' tweets.
I was going to talk about a couple things I've seen. We're almost at an hour, though, so I'm going to do a little bit of rapid fire because this will just be the show. I've explained that I'm not leaving the house. And in a period of whatever you would call it, I don't know. It's not agoraphobia, but it's getting there.
Not leaving the house is fine. We have to get you to start up the fireplace.
No, that's never going to happen. But the one advantage to not leaving the house and cutting way back on writing and work and stuff for my own health is that we've watched a lot of movies. We're watching like a movie every day, sometimes more than one.
That's a good thing.
And trying to fill in a bunch of gaps and watching a lot of old stuff. A couple new things when we get screeners, but the screeners really haven't started coming in. And most of the ones that have come in, either we've seen or it's like, I don't think I'm going to watch that. The two sort of new, besides Suspiria, we watched Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Which you warned me away from.
Do not see. And then a movie that I know you saw because we talked about it when I think we went to see Hamilton, which is Puzzle.
Yes.
Boy, you weren't kidding. That is a piece of shit. I'm sorry. That's a horrible way to talk about a movie. I did not like Puzzle.
And neither did I. And because I have so much time on my hands, we talked about this the last podcast.
Yeah.
Why not go see it?
Sure.
So there's all these movies this year that are why not go see it.
Yeah.
But the skeleton of that thing, the architecture of it, is so naked in terms of...
Oh, it's embarrassing just right away when you're like, see the puzzle and it's this metaphor. And she's... Eric and I just sat there the whole time like, how does this woman have adult children? Is she 27? Kelly McDonald,
no.
I know she's very youthful
but
looking.
She is the definition of an idiot savant.
We
the,
could not figure out, is
the
her
emphasis
character
on idiot.
Supposed to be special needs? Is
and
she on the spectrum? What
the
is the story?
The actor who played the puzzle master.
Yes.
Who I'm a big fan
he's
of.
Great.
Whenever he shows up.
Irfan Khan, I believe.
That maybe, you know, you just, because you spent 2 hours with it, you want it to work so much better. Maybe if he was actually shittier, it would work. It
was, and when it took the turn that it takes, I was like, what? That's where this movie is going? Anyway, not a fan of
I'm
Puzzle.
So glad you agree with me on Puzzle, because it's going to take me a couple minutes to summon it. There was another movie this year that's exactly like Puzzle that I went to see it. And I've since talked to some people who liked it, but in fact, my wife liked it more than I did. Juliet Naked.
I haven't seen it. Yeah.
The actor was in First Reformed.
Ethan Hawke.
Ethan Hawke is great in everything, and he tries, but just like Puzzle, the construction is so naked. Mm-hmm. It's like you're watching a building that's transparent and you're there to see I talked to someone recently who liked it. Was at Thanksgiving. I talked to someone who liked it, but just so formulaic. Mm-hmm. So, or is this just the two of us and our rarefied air that we go to see more movies than the average person, so the formula is more
maybe
obvious to us?
Maybe.
But Puzzle and Juliet Naked are very much of a piece. Okay. If you look at it carefully.
Okay. Watched a documentary called Bad Reputation, which is all about Joan Jett, which is delightful. It presents no real new information. It gives you no actual insight into
Joan
Jett.
They released a soundtrack from it.
But it's an hour and a half, like, man, Joan Jett's the best, isn't she?
One night I had a choice between the new Gilda documentary and the new Joan Jett documentary, and I chose the Gilda documentary.
How is it?
The Gilda documentary is good.
Okay. Sad, so I avoided it.
Yeah.
I went Joan Jett.
You know what I noticed lately? When Netflix added all the Monty Python episodes, they also added everything Monty Python. And I would like to be the first person in podcast history to suggest this, because I've been going crazy lately with Monty Python. There are now on Netflix more Monty Python documentaries by runtime than the runtime of the original 45 episodes that spawned them.
That's pretty funny.
There's the five-part, five-hour Truth with Jokes.
Yeah.
There's a documentary before they were Python. There's Parrot Sketch Not Included, the Steve Martin thing. There's a documentary about the O2 show they did to wind up their careers. There's Personal Best. So there's a half an hour for each of them. There's another thing where Netflix got five famous people, and each episode is a famous person talking about their famous sketches. And now that I've worked my way through all of that, and I don't blame the Monty Python guys. Good Lord. The same stories over and over and over, practically word for word. So, folks, I love Monty Python, but watch the Joan Jett documentary.
It's really, if you like Joan Jett, it's just a reminder that she's awesome.
I'm so happy you hated Puzzle.
Yeah, sorry. Watching a lot of Criterion titles.
Before Filmstruck goes out of business, or just off disc?
Just off disc. Stuff that I haven't watched, or that Erica's never seen.
Like?
So we watched All That Jazz, which I had never seen.
Formative film of my childhood.
Really?
What did you think?
It was fascinating. I mean, it was interesting because we watched a bunch of stuff from the 70s in a row, and I was pointing out that when I cover the 70s in class, that we'll usually watch two, sometimes three movies, and they always kind of end the same way, and I turn the lights on, and I always explain, it's the 70s, everyone. Fuck you.
Oh, yeah.
And that every movie we watched, whether it was Nashville or Heaven's Gate or one that I'll talk about in just a minute or All That Jazz, it's hey, it's the 70s. Fuck you.
But at the time that Bob Fosse made All That Jazz, that particular brand of acid irony wasn't quite as pervasive.
Okay.
So when you get to the end and Ben Vereen just giving the best self-parroting, unctuous, here's a cat who has been my close personal, and then he's introducing the open heart surgery and then the death of the protagonist. When that film came out, that would, and I cannot describe to you the reaction, because the actual open heart surgery footage is presented as part of a musical number.
Right.
Say what you want about Fosse. He was self-aware. Jesus Christ.
It's dark, man. It's and
did you know Roy Scheider could sing?
No. Erica fell asleep for the last 2 minutes. And so I had to describe. She said, what I miss? And I said, well, here's what it was. And she didn't believe me. She said, that's how it ended? I said, yeah, that's how it ended. Heaven's Gate, which I mentioned, which was amazing. And then I went back and reread your article. And
so just recently you saw it for the
I had never
time.
Seen it. I'd watched the first half hour probably 4 times. And it's such a commitment that I was always like, I can't watch this.
And this is why film history is wrong. And when a movie first comes out, everyone's wrong. And that whole Medved books, the Golden Hurley Awards, that movie was pilloried when it came out as one of the worst movies ever made. So
were they just reviewing Cimino?
Or the budget, or as countless celebrities have pointed out.
The structure is Deer Hunter.
First they build you up,
right?
And then, oh, look
created. Right.
And then there's only one way to go. Right. Now we have to destroy it.
Right. I found myself a little frustrated at the opening. We get that very long Harvard graduation, and John Hurt gives this interminable speech. And I was like, okay, just because we saw the wedding in Deer Hunter, we don't have to watch the whole graduation.
The
structure is Deer Hunter. But
all the
God damn that movie.
I would even argue, and I love Deer Hunter. We've done a podcast on it. All of the subplots involving all of the other characters, like Jeff Bridges and especially
Christopher Walken.
Yes.
Oh, man.
Are just...
Oh, Christopher Walken.
Back when he wasn't this parody of himself.
Yeah.
Are so interesting and so thought-provoking and so well-observed.
Yeah.
That movie is so great.
After we saw Hamilton.
Well, I don't mean to interrupt you. The same thing happened to Sorcerer. Remember when we
Yeah, that movie's amazing, too.
This is one of the worst films. Jesus Christ.
The standard may have been a little higher back then.
So after we went to see Hamilton, because this is going to surprise some of our listeners, both Patrick and I wanted to be in the room where it happens.
It's amazing how many of the songs I remember. After having only seen it once.
Well, I knew the shot one because that was sort of the
See,
hit.
I didn't know anything.
When that came out. And then I think because of the Tony Awards, what are the sisters' names?
I don't know.
The Sullivan sisters?
Sure.
And every time I hear that song, it's like, oh, they're praising New York in a Broadway show. That's a real gamble. Have you noticed how many Broadway shows bend over backwards to like, and this isn't even... The greatest city in the world. Are you listening, people in the audience?
So after we saw Hamilton,
it's
unbelievable.
It's an unbelievable work of art.
Yeah, and I was talking about Aaron Burr and how he's the most interesting character in the show, and that's the part you want. And I said, well, you know, really, it's just it's Amadeus. And Erica admitted to me she had never seen Amadeus, and I thought, holy shit, you've never seen Amadeus? Amadeus is a movie that. Should repel me just in terms of like I have a resistance to period stuff,
but
and I'm
because
not
because it's Miloš Forman.
I've seen it probably 5 times, and I mean it's like it's hyperbolic to say that like I still think it's like one of the best movies I've ever seen, but I just think the world of it.
It's certainly one of the best movies about art.
Oh my God, it's so interesting. The whole character of Salieri and F. Murray Abraham, who is almost always overacting in everything, is so incredible in every goddamn scene.
And I would argue that Thomas Hulse
also
brings it because his whole job is to be, how is that music coming out of you?
Right. It presents such interesting ideas. And the whole time we're watching it, I just was like, can you imagine this movie getting made today? This movie set in a period that's clearly very expensive about art and classical music, and it's made about adults and it's for adults. And just every movie we've watched lately, it's like, oh, this doesn't exist anymore.
And
this is gone.
What is the source? I recently went back and reread my column about Anonymous. A film that no one has thought about for 7 years, thank God. And Anonymous proffers the weak tea that Shakespeare did not write his plays, that someone in the upper class did, because that's this classist racist argument, and it's the nature of genius. My favorite line in the entire film, Amadeus, is, at times it seemed like he was taking dictation from God.
Yeah.
And that's what genius is. How did Lennon McCartney wrote those songs? Yeah.
Right.
That's
right.
Right. I could never write those songs. No.
Exactly.
Not at all. That's
right.
That's what it is.
And his awareness of his own limitations, but his ability to appreciate it's so
And also the self-loathing that comes.
Oh, my God. If, and his anger at God.
If you know enough about music, as Salieri did, that deep down he knows it shows the universe is out of whack, that he's getting the accolades
right.
and this stuff.
Yes.
Oh. Too many notes.
Love it. Jeffrey Jones. Oh, God. I love it. It's so beautiful,
you
too.
You said Aaron Burr was the best part in Hamilton. I would disagree. I think King George is.
No, yeah.
And
I mean, he's fun.
This is based on
Or Thomas Jefferson.
Because he gets so many laughs. I was once in a play in high school. I was in a lot of plays in high school. But the one I'm thinking of, I was only in two scenes. And big laughs in both scenes. I was the lead's boss.
Okay.
So I'm the funny boss. You get to be in the play.
Uh-huh.
There aren't a lot of pesky lines to memorize. You come in, mm-hmm. you glow, you leave. You still get to go to the cast party. And that's the King George part.
Absolutely.
You come on, it's hilarious, and then
you
get to go backstage.
Do you know Neil Simon's Fools?
Yeah.
Right. So we did Fools in high school, and I was the bad guy.
I was there for decades. We did Fools more than once.
Okay. I was in a production of Fools, and I was the bad guy, so I just show up for three scenes. I get to talk directly to the audience and be funny. It's what Patton Oswalt calls jetpack acting, where you just fly in on your jetpack, you get some laughs, and you fly away.
That's the part. That's one of the only good things about being a character actor. You come in, you score,
right?
And I literally remember sitting backstage thinking, I am so happy. When's the cast party?
Yep. Anyway, Amadeus, man, I love it. And the last movie I'll talk about, and I know we have to wrap up for a lot of reasons, but one is Nicholas Roeg died, and so I watched for the first time Bad Timing.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a movie I knew about, I think, from the Z Channel documentary.
Mm-hmm.
Had never seen it.
There was a period of time where you couldn't.
Which I read about.
And I drove to Facets
one
night to see a very battered 16mm print. Yeah. And I was really glad I did, because there's a lot of really interesting things going on in that film.
So from the time it left theaters in 1980 until I think 2005, right?
Easily.
Because it never got a VHS release. It didn't, it didn't get a DVD release until 2005. I was reading a little bit on it, just the Wikipedia page, about two-thirds of the way through. And it was talking about this movie was rated X. It was banned in parts of the UK. And the review was, this is a sick movie made by sick people for sick people. And I was like, well, it's dealing with some dark
stuff. Just like Heaven's Gate and Sorcerer.
Right. It's dealing with some dark stuff the way that Carnal Knowledge does or whatever.
Right.
But not to make the Art Garfunkel connection. But what are they even talking
Their
about?
Their objection all comes down to that one scene.
And then we got to the scene and I said, oh, okay. I don't agree, but I understand.
But
what...
if we accept that the film is art, the purpose of this piece of art is to get you
exactly
to look at that and think about it
right.
and draw an opinion of what is this?
Right.
And how do you feel about this?
And it...
Because folks, he's not actually doing it. It's a crazy make-em-up.
And we've spent 2 hours building to that moment, not to justify it, but to get to that. I don't know. I was pretty knocked out by it.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
Because we don't talk about these things ahead of time, I wasn't sure. I haven't seen it in 10 or 20 years.
It's really good.
Oh, no. It's out on Criterion, right?
DVD. They haven't done the Blu-ray
right.
yet.
No, I remember being knocked out by it, and certainly the most interesting thing I'd ever seen Art Garfunkel in, and I like him as an actor. I like the other things he's done.
One thing I was commenting on at the time, and we're not going to get to the other stuff, but in the early 80s, there was a specific type of role, and it's kind of the femme fatale part. Kathleen Turner got some of them. Teresa Russell got a lot of them. Who are that actress doesn't exist anymore.
No, because...
Is there a modern-day Teresa Russell?
Because, we got the Ruth Bader Ginsburg biopic coming out, but I don't know. Is there a lot of strong women in movies anymore? That, too, seems to have moved to television.
I think that there are, but I think they're strong in a different way.
Yeah.
And I think there are certainly actors, you know, I was like, well, Amy Adams could probably play the Teresa Russell part.
Sure.
But I would know that she was faking the whole time. And with Teresa Russell, you're like, no, you are this person. It's pretty incredible. Anyway.
Teresa Russell is an incredible actress. I've seen her in a bunch of stuff, and she's always great. Very quickly before we sign off, Criterion just released Some Like It Hot.
Yes.
There's been a delay in a lot of Blu-ray releases because we're down to one manufacturing plant, and it's not in the United States, and some things are delayed. So the Criterion releases were delayed by 1 week each, which was a problem because the Barnes & Noble sale is still going on, and you want to get those for 50% off. So Some Like It Hot came out. This is a film I showed every semester in film study for 3 decades. It's a film I'm very familiar with, and I put it in this morning to look at the transfer so I could talk about it. And it's really, really interesting because I think both of us agree we don't like it when they tweak it to such an extent that it looks like a videotape.
Oh, yeah.
So at first I'm watching it, I'm disappointed because there's a lot of grain. But then as the film went along and we're getting to scenes that I've seen 130 times before, they struck a perfect balance between film and video that I'm watching it and I'm thinking, I am sitting in the music box watching the most pristine 35. So it's beautiful to look at.
All right.
They ported over most of the extras. That was one of their first Laserdisc titles. And it had home movie footage of Tony Curtis on the set. That hasn't been ported over. But the audio commentary has from the original Laserdisc, which is the expert talking, but it's got little snippets of interview with Jack Lemmon. It's very, very well done.
I'm excited for the
disc. Very, very worth listening to. And as I pointed out on Twitter this morning, 5 years ago, I wrote a column about True Stories, a movie I love.
Yeah.
And at the end of the column, I said, Criterion, this needs to come out. Now, it took them 5 years. But I think
better
it's interesting. In the column, I said, maybe one of the bonus features can be this soundtrack album that's never really been released.
Yeah.
And a bonus feature, it's supposed to arrive at my house today.
Oh, yay.
Is a CD.
I didn't realize that.
Because when the movie came out, the Talking Heads put out an album of them performing the songs.
Right.
And then, to give you an idea of how long ago this was, to get the movie tracks, you had to buy the singles. And the B-side of the singles were John Goodman singing People Like Us, Pop Staples singing Papa Legba. You had to buy a series of vinyl singles. The new Criterion release that drops today comes with a soundtrack.
That's interesting.
All the Talking Head stuff,
Is that why that one's like $5 more than the other ones?
Maybe.
Because everything on sale is $20 and that one's always $25.
Because that movie has looked really bad.
Yeah.
For a really long time.
Full frame DVD and that's it.
And I can't wait. David Byrne is obviously behind this release because he's been tweeting about it too. Like, oh, check it out.
Yeah.
Because it's great. And I can't wait to see it. And assuming it does drop today, you got 2 or 3 days to get it from Barnes & Noble at 50% off.
Yeah, absolutely. You should. Thank you guys very much for listening. Remember, check us out every day at fthismovie.com. Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Facebook, and you can find us in iTunes and blah, 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 blah.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.